Chapter 22. Astonishment took him under his protection, and informed King Philip that he found he could not give him leave to invade England. The angry Philip resolved to do it without his leave, but he gained nothing and lost much. For the English, commanded by the Earl of Salisbury, went over, in 500 ships, to the French coast, before the French fleet had sailed away from it, and utterly defeated the whole. The Pope then took off his three sentences, one after another, and empowered Stephen Langton publicly, to receive King John into the favor of the Church again, and to ask him to dinner. The King, who hated Langton with all his might and main, and with reason too, for he was a great and a good man, with whom such a king could have no sympathy, pretended to cry, and to be very grateful. There was a little difficulty about settling how much the king should pay as a recompense to the clergy for the losses he had caused them, but the end of it was that the superior clergy got a good deal, and the inferior clergy got little or nothing, which has also happened since King John's time, I believe. When all these matters were arranged, the king in his triumph became more fierce, and false, and insolent to all around him than he had ever been. An alliance of sovereigns against King Philip gave him an opportunity of landing an army in France, with which he even took a town. But, on the French king's gaining a great victory, he ran away, of course, and made a truce for 5 years. And now the time approached when he was to be still further humbled, and made to feel, if he could feel anything, what a wretched creature he was. Of all men in the world, Stephen Langton seemed raised up by heaven to oppose and subdue him. When he ruthlessly burned and destroyed the property of his own subjects, because their lords, the barons, would not serve him abroad, Stephen Langton fearlessly reproved and threatened him. When he swore to restore the laws of King Edward, or the laws of King Henry I, Stephen Langton knew his falsehood, and pursued him through all his evasions. When the barons met at the Abbey of St. Edmund's Bury, to consider their wrongs and the king's oppressions, Stephen Langton roused them by his fervid words, to demand a solemn charter of rights and liberties from their perjured master, and to swear, one by one, on the high altar, that they would have it, or would wage war against him to the death. When the king hid himself in London from the barons, and was at last obliged to receive them, they told him roundly they would not believe him, unless Stephen Langton became a surety that he would keep his word. When he took the cross to invest himself with some interest, and belong to something that was received with favor, Stephen Langton was still immovable. When he appealed to the Pope, and the Pope wrote to Stephen Langton in behalf of his new favorite, Stephen Langton was deaf, even to the Pope himself, and saw before him nothing but the welfare of England, and the crimes of the English king. At Easter time, the barons assembled at Stamford, in Lincolnshire, in proud array, and, marching near to Oxford where the king was, delivered into the hands of Stephen Langton and two others a list of grievances. And these, apostrophe they said, he must redress, or we will do it for ourselves. Apostrophe, apostrophe. When Stephen Langton told the king as much, and read the list to him, he went half mad with rage. But that did him no more good than his afterwards trying to pacify the barons with lies. They called themselves and their followers the Army of God and the Holy Church. Apostrophe, marching through the country, with the people thronging to them everywhere except at Northampton, where they failed in an attack upon the castle, they at last triumphantly set up their banner in London itself, whither the whole land, tired of the tyrant, seemed to flock to join them. 7 knights alone, of all the knights in England, remained with the king, who, reduced to this strait, at last sent the Earl of Pembroke to the barons to say that he approved of everything, and would meet them to sign their charter when they would. Then, apostrophe, said the barons, let the day be the 15th of June, and the place, Runnymede. apostrophe, on Monday, the 15th of June, 1214. The king came from Windsor Castle, and the barons came from the town of Staines, and they met on Runnymede, which is still a pleasant meadow by the Thames, where rushes grow in the clear water of the winding river, and its banks are green with grass and trees. On the side of the barons came the general of their army, Robert Fitzwalter, and a great concourse of the nobility of England. With the king came, in all, some 24 persons of any note, most of whom despised him, and were merely his advisers in form. On that great day, and in that great company, the king signed Magna Charta, the great charter of England, by which he pledged himself to maintain the church in its rights, to relieve the barons of oppressive obligations as vassals of the crown, of which the barons, in their turn, pledged themselves to relieve their vassals, the people, to respect the liberties of London, and all other cities and boroughs, to protect foreign merchants who came to England, to imprison no man without a fair trial, and to sell, delay, or deny justice to none. As the barons knew his falsehood well, they further required, as their securities, that he should send out of his kingdom all his foreign troops, that for 2 months they should hold possession of the city of London, and Stephen Langton of the Tower, and that 25 of their body, chosen by themselves, should be a lawful committee to watch the keeping of the charter, and to make war upon him, if he broke it. All this he was obliged to yield. He signed the charter with a smile, and, if he could have looked agreeable, would have done so, as he departed from the splendid assembly. When he got home to Windsor Castle, he was quite a madman in his helpless fury, and he broke the charter immediately afterwards. He sent abroad for foreign soldiers, and sent to the Pope for help, and plotted to take London by surprise, while the barons should be holding a great tournament at Stamford, which they had agreed to hold there as a celebration of the charter. The barons, however, found him out, and put it off. Then, when the barons desired to see him, and tax him with his treachery, he made numbers of appointments with them, and kept none, and shifted from place to place, and was constantly sneaking and skulking about. At last he appeared at Dover, to join his foreign soldiers, of whom numbers came into his pay, and with them, he besieged and took Rochester Castle, which was occupied by knights and soldiers of the barons. He would have hanged them every one, but the leader of the foreign soldiers, fearful of what the English people might afterwards do to him, interfered to save the knights. Therefore the king was fain to satisfy his vengeance with the death of all the common men. Then, he sent the Earl of Salisbury, with one portion of his army, to ravage the eastern part of his own dominions, while he carried fire and slaughter into the northern part, torturing, plundering, killing, and inflicting every possible cruelty upon the people, and, every morning, setting a worthy example to his men by setting fire, with his own monster hands, to the house where he had slept last night. Nor was this all, for the Pope, coming to the aid of his precious friend, laid the kingdom under an interdict again, because the people took part with the barons. It did not much matter, for the people had grown so used to it now, that they had begun to think nothing about it. It occurred to them, perhaps to Stephen Langton too, that they could keep their churches open, and ring their bells, without the Pope's permission as well as with it. So, they tried the experiment and found, that it succeeded perfectly. It being now impossible to bear the country, as a wilderness of cruelty, or longer to hold any terms with such a forsworn outlaw of a king, the barons sent to Louis, son of the French monarch, to offer him the English crown. Caring as little for the Pope's excommunication of him, if he accepted the offer, as it is possible his father may have cared for the Pope's forgiveness of his sins, he landed at Sandwich, King John immediately running away from Dover, where he happened to be, and went on to London. The Scottish king, with whom many of the northern English lords had taken refuge, numbers of the foreign soldiers, numbers of the barons, and numbers of the people went over to him every day. King John, the while, continually running away in all directions. The career of Louis was checked, however, by the suspicions of the barons, founded on the dying declaration of a French lord, that when the kingdom was conquered he was sworn to banish them as traitors, and to give their estates to some of his own nobles. Rather than suffer this, some of the barons hesitated. Others even went over to King John. It seemed to be the turning point of King John's fortunes, for, in his savage and murderous course, he had now taken some towns and met with some successes. But, happily for England and humanity, his death was near. Crossing a dangerous quicksand, called the Wash, not very far from Wisbech, the tide came up and nearly drowned his army. He and his soldiers escaped. But, looking back from the shore when he was safe, he saw the roaring water sweep down in a torrent, overturn the wagons, horses, and men that carried his treasure, and engulf them in a raging whirlpool from which nothing could be delivered. Cursing, and swearing, and gnawing his fingers, he went on to Swinestead Abbey, where the monks set before him quantities of pears, and peaches, and new cider, some say poison too, but there is very little reason to suppose so, of which he ate and drank in an immoderate and beastly way. All night he lay ill of a burning fever, and haunted with horrible fears. Next day, they put him in a horse litter, and carried him to Sleaford Castle, where he passed another night of pain and horror. Next day, they carried him, with greater difficulty than on the day before, to the castle of Newark upon Trent, and there, on the 18th of October, in the 49th year of his age, and the 17th of his vile reign, was an end of this miserable brute. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.